Okay, so welcome to the final discussion of this conference. Unlike the other discussions, this one is somewhat less focused. We don't have a very specific topic, but of course, you will be welcome at the end to extend questions to any of our speakers and presenters. The first presentation of this discussion will be somewhat specific. We asked Ami Katz to tell us in 5 minutes about flavor physics, so let's see if he does.
All right, so. Of course, from the string theory side so far in this conference, we've seen mostly the physics of various versions of super Yang-Mills or things that are dual to the closed strings. But of course, we know that QCD quarks are important. It's somewhat like making apple pie but not having apples. So we have to figure out how to add quarks into the picture. And I'm just going to try to briefly review what has been done about that. So much as this little guy suggests, when you add quarks, that means you want to add open strings, where the quarks are kind of sitting at the endpoints. And as Joe has taught us, open strings means that we're adding D-brains to the geometry. And whereas generically it's actually quite difficult to do this, except for one particular case of the D2, D6 brain system, where some explicit and quite calculable things can be done. It's actually quite non-trivial because you have to account for the back reaction of these D brains. You have to essentially solve systems with multiple brains, and it's highly non-trivial. And so for a while there hasn't been much progress on that, but then we lowered our expectations and decided, why don't we try to understand the quenched approximation at least. So the idea is take much less flavors than there are colors. And then the point is that these D-brains, the flavor D-brains, are now going to be probes of the geometry which is already there, set up by the Yang-Mills closed string dual. And so we won't have to work too hard because we don't have to have the D-brains back react on the geometry. We just sort of embed the D-brains in the geometry. So the whole trick is to figure out how it is that these brains are sitting in the geometry. And this has been done in many cases. We already kind of have n equals 2 examples and D-brain embeddings in Klebanov-Strassler, even recently, and other sort of kind of confining theories. And what this looks like qualitatively is very much so we've kind of gotten used to this dictionary that tells us that the radial direction in the ADS space is supposed to correspond to energy. And what happens is that the D-brain, the flavor brain, just fills space, part of the space. So if the quark is massive, the brain will end someplace. So very much in the infrared, you don't see the effect of the quark anymore. But when you go into the UV region, you see this flavor brain, and on it there live open strings. And so, for instance, in the case of the n equals 2 story, where you take n equals 4 Yang-Mills and you just couple it to hypermultiplets, you can find that the mass of the hadrons that you get, sort of this position of where the brain ends, is characteristic of the mass of the hadrons that are given by fluctuations of this D brain, the fields that live on the D brain. Their characteristic scale goes like the mass of the quark over the Tilth coupling. But the whole point here is that even though there's very few flavors in the game, you can still get a lot out qualitatively out of these models. Like, for example, you can study meson spectroscopy, both looking at D-brain fields as well as looking at kind of semi-classical open strings that are spinning around in this D-brain that have very, very large charges. So some of the same stories that we've seen in the closed strings physics, you can also repeat for the open strings. You can study Kharlamov symmetry breaking, which is basically dual to the Higgsing of the D-brain. So this D-brain has some gauge fields living on it. These gauge fields are dual to the flavor symmetries. And so chiral symmetry breaking is very naturally corresponds to the Higgsing of these gauge fields in the bulk. Other types of qualitative features that you can find are the breaking of flux tubes. So now that you've added dynamical quarks, so now strings can end on these flavor brains. And so if you look at the old Maldacena Wilson loop calculation, instead of just having a Wilson loop that kind of dangles into the bulk, you can actually end the Wilson loop on this flavor brain because it's a D brain. And so you could see how the flux tube breaks because of the presence of dynamical quarks. Of course, we've just begun sort of studying these systems, and there are many open questions. For instance, heavy light mesons are kind of a challenge because they involve two energy scales. I mean, on one hand, you've got some very light quark that's living over here. On the other hand, you have some heavy quark that's living in the UV. And so to describe a heavy light system, you naturally have to have a string. And so it'd be very interesting to basically study see what we can say about it. For instance, calculate something like the Isger-Weiss function and see if there's some generic predictions that one can make, just some generic features from the string calculation. Of course, baryons, something which is missing in this picture. We've talked just about mesons, and it's possible that one can make a connection with the old the skirmion discussion that we saw today, namely that the baryons are just supposed to be solutions, solitonic solutions of these gauge bosons, and it's possible that you won't have to go to the boundary of the effective theory. You won't have to balance terms of different order against each other because you're sort of integrated back the rho mesons and the vector mesons, which are naturally the degrees of freedom living on this V-brain. Form factors, Matt and the students have started some of this study, but we've just begun. And of course, going beyond the probe limit is essential, especially if you want to capture some of the really interesting phase diagram physics of super QCD. Certainly, you need to take NF to be of order in C. Finally, let me just quickly mention that this framework is perfect for building the kinds of models that Raman was talking about earlier during the conference, because they naturally allow you to embed the standard model gauge fields to live on these flavor brains. And so you might attempt to take a KKLT-like model and just embed 7 brains, for instance, into it. And finally, one should not forget that some of the lightest QCD states are actually mesons. And so to the extent that the infrared of the theory is strongly coupled, one might hope that perhaps the geometric description of these guys is not completely insane. And so you could sort of take the old framework or the QCD sum rules pioneered by SVZ and try to come up with a holographic version of them. You take the QCD OPE, literally the QCD OPE, and you let that try to determine the action for you on this D-brain. And you get some quantitative as well as lots of qualitative agreement. Like, for example, rho meson dominance comes out more automatically. The effect of the masses of the quarks and the on the masses of the mesons is something you can calculate. You can get omega phi mixing. Of course, you can also get the GOR relation. And so, yeah, I'm stuck right here.
Okay, questions?
Could you say more how the rho meson dominance comes automatically?
Yeah, so what happens is, essentially, the rho meson is the lightest state in the bulk, and so it's flat. As long as its wave function is flat, then it behaves very much like a gauge boson within the bulk. So its couplings are universal to all the states whose overlap with it see it mostly as a flat wave function. So for all the infrared states, which kind of live in the infrared part of this geometry, so somewhere over here, I'm assuming it's a light brain, so I'm extending this whole brain down to the infrared, and the rho meson profile is something like this. It sort of starts out flat and then kind of dies down around its mass. And so for any of the states that live here, they all have the same overlap with it since it's basically flat. So it comes out automatically.
Okay, I just want to make a comment that if we make a very simple five-dimensional theory with the gauge fields that is SU to left cross SU to right, you can sort of rederive some of the old QCD sum rule result, that is F pi square over M rho square is equal NC over 24 pi square, etc.
I have a question. One of your points say many open questions, and then at least the questions, and then there are some names attached to it. Does it mean that some questions are closed already by these red people, or
no,
what?
No. So The only, so these are not, this is, has not been done. Some people are starting to work on this, but certainly nothing has been published quite yet. Form factors, Matt has worked on this, and he has some beginning results on this, but you know, this is the first paper for which he's considered this.
So some questions are beginning to be...
Yeah, most of them are not answered. I mean, these...
Okay, so let's thank Ami and move to the next presenter. So our next presenter will be David Bernstein, who we gave an open hand to say whatever he wants to.
Thank you. Okay, so I was asked by the organizers to be provocative and to say where we're going. So there's one transparency. And I'm a theorist, so I have to improvise with the amount of room given. So the question is, what are the prospects for large N? And then I'm going to give you a string theory's wish list. And of course, the holy grail is to solve large N QCD. Even without flavor, this is an important problem. So this is what we want to get at. And we believe that it's a confining theory and that it will have strings in it. Well, next best option, if this cannot happen, is to solve any theory at all in the large N limit. So we can solve the large N limit of N equal 4 Yang-Mills theory. This would be a great accomplishment. And the real reason why we like it is because we know what the dual string theory is. This is what the alias CFT is about. And the definition is not just at the level of a perturbative string theory, it's really a non-perturbative definition of the N equal 4 Yang-Mills theory. It's a non-perturbative definition of the string theory. So before we get to the non-perturbative aspects, of course, there's strings. We have strings, the strings, we heard a lot about integrability. This is a very important property because it means that, in some sense, the theory is solvable and calculable, which is a very important thing. If it's to be a toy model where we're going to learn stuff, we need to be able to calculate things. Well, it seems that today, this is the power of modern physics, is that we get the preprints the same day they're posted. There seems to be a proof by Berkowitz of exactly this fact at the level of the quantum string. Using his formalism, the proof seems to be very technical, but if you read into it and the way the abstract is phrased and the way everything is phrased, there is a proof of integrability on the LES side of N equal 4, of the string of N equal 4.
String or super Young Mills?
Well, in some sense, that's supposed to be equivalent. So in existence of infinitely many charges is, in some sense, the statement that the theory is integrable for the string. Because usually, the infinitely many charges are exactly the action angle variables. The charges correspond to the action variables. Well, there are theories where you can split the two sectors, where one is integrable and the other one is not. But usually, for the whole package to be integrable, you at least need that, and it seems to be integrable. So the question is, well, is this the full integrability, or are we getting close there? Now, integrability is not going to hold in the in the QCD string. We've already heard about that, that there's violations at one loop for certain types of questions. But there are lessons we can learn from integrability, which are very old, and this is back from the 60s. Well, there's bosonization and fermionization. This is one of the really strong aspects of that came out of integrability, that we could turn fermions into bosons. And this is important because it could mean that this is the way that the dual of the QCD string is a superstring. It could be that we start with something which looks like an ordinary bosonic theory, and when we go to the right vacuum, the ferromagnet or the antiferromagnet, depending on how things go, it is really the fermions of this collective vacuum that gets formed that give you the fermions that tell you that it's a superstring and not just an ordinary string. Of course, this is all speculation, but superstrings are nicer than strings sometimes, so why not a superstring? Okay, now there's the next question, which is the question of Steve Giddings that we heard a lot, which is holography. Can we solve quantum gravity, and can we understand the local geometry in ADS space just from ordinary quantum field theory on n equal 4 Young Mills. There's more. This non-perturbative equivalence between Young Mills and ADS-CFT tells you that if it's a string theory, there will be probably D brains. And in some sense, we know a little bit about that. It's the flavor problem going to the Kurov branch, but we also have baryons. These are also like D brains. And we get a different style of integrability on the Coulomb branch, for example, Seiberg-Witten story. Well, what else did we see? We saw a Fermi liquid picture. This was the talk of Oleg Lunin. There was some relation to quantum Hall effect, and there's this brain flux replacement, which is very analog to confinement. So we're seeing some things that could be related to that. Let me go a little bit further on where is a lot of this stuff hidden. Is in the operator state correspondence. We've been talking about operators and states, and basically the statement is that the metric on Euclidean R4 is conformally equivalent to the metric of an S3 cross R. So the rest of this transparency is how close is QCD to ACFT? So close means in the following way. We can take the conformal group and break it in two ways to obtain two spacetimes, which are nice. One of them is Minkowski, which is the standard way to break conformal symmetry, just less alpha prime 1. The other one is take the maximal compact subgroup of SO42, which is SO4 cross SO2, which is S3 cross R. And then what happens is that in this case, you get more Casimirs than in this one. So this might be a better place to do QCD than this place, just from group theory. So what I propose is that we all study QCD on a finite geometry, which is S3 cross R. The advantage of S3 is that there are no holonomies, so we don't have to worry too much about the infrared physics. It's free of infrared divergences, and we introduce a new scale, and there might even be a large n finite volume phase transition. How might that happen? It might look like a change in topology or something else, but it could be there. So why not? The next point that I want to make about this is that it is more partonic. There's finite number of partons in the infrared which are on shell. This means that the discretization of the QCD string, as we have been doing in terms of operators, is a lot cleaner, a lot easier to understand. And it leads to some sort of finite matrix quantum mechanics. And then, even in finite matrix quantum mechanics, we can show that there are no trivial string duals and that you have some Hagedorn spectrum of states. So this will tell you something about the string. And then what happens is roughly the number of matrices is the number of spin states per site in the spin chain. The last point is there's semi-classical strings. These are what we call the rigid trajectories, semi-classical in some sense. There's some large quantum number. Non-trivial classical configurations break the worldsheet conformal invariance, and what can happen there is that basically the classical configuration, when you pick a gauge which is convenient for this classical configuration, you get massive modes on the string because worldsheet conformal invariance is not important anymore. And this might be exactly how we see the rigidity or the fermions or anything else as was being discussed earlier. So this is it.
Okay. Questions? Comments?
It's about this fermionization and humanization. If I can try to compare it with the experience in this 1+1 dimensional series, then if you will take, say, sine Gordon model, but subsymmetric one, kind of the nice ways of presenting the series is to put everything as fermions. Because, I mean, you can.
Right.
And then supersymmetry becomes just, you know, SUM group, you know, you have more fermions and you have some kind of, group, then I live in the space of some group and I have this expression of supersymmetry. I mean, I, in this sense, could it be something similar for supersymmetry?
Maybe. I hope it is in some sense. I think we all hope that the QC string is a superstring, but it could be that it's not the case. And this is just speculation at some point. We need a proof of principle.
How would you look for the fermionic degrees in the semi-classical limit, if there are some?
Well, in the semi-classical limit, you don't expect to see supersymmetry, so you expect the fermions on the worksheet to be massive.
So the supersymmetry, you see, the supersymmetric would remain on the microscopic level.
Right.
You mentioned that the quantum integrability has hopefully been proven. So what's the next step to do for solving the worldsheet theory?
Well, the formalism in which the quantum integrability was proven is not the easiest one to understand, but we hope that it actually leads to some calculational scheme to find all the energies of all the states of the strings in AVS 5 process 5 somewhat systematically. That's the hope. It's a dream. Integrability does not mean solvability. It means that you somehow can separate variables and still work with these variables in some way.
I want to ask a question regarding this fermionic strings or structure on the string. Because as far as I understand, what you were trying to provoke people to do is to develop some kind of string formulation of just QCD, right?
Yes.
Okay, so in QCD, for instance, QCD string, well, flux tube or whatever, it's not real string, but let's say in QCD we can pose such a question. We can have two fundamental strings close to each other, and then they fuse into one string, let's say two string. And then we know that this two string has a ground state, and it has lots of excitations, and the splitting between the ground state and excitations is 1 over n squared. It's a small parameter, okay? Mm-hmm. So I was wondering how, in the string theory, how would it be possible to get something like this?
In the n equals 1 star theory, we actually, you know, these things come up. And I think also Chris Herzog and Igor Klebanov thought about this as well. The point is that there is a three-string junction, which is a D-brain.
Yes.
And so there can be some sort of non-perturbative object around, which allows two strings to become one string going the other direction. We're really doing NC equals 3.
No, now, of course, this I know, that you can have two strings fusing together for a junction, right? But okay. How do you get very...
Are you talking about large N?
Very small splittings between the ground state and excitations. How do you get excitations in general and the splitting, which is very small?
So can you say again, you're working at large N?
Well, I'm working in QCD, large N QCD. So okay. If you have a string whose source is two index fermion, it can be in symmetric or anti-symmetric representation. The ground state is anti-symmetric. Symmetric is excited string, but it's very close. The splitting between the tensions is 1 over n squared effect. So, and you have other excitations. So you have very neat, the whole ladder of very closely lying excitations. So the question is, how would you view the possibility or anticipate of doing something of this type in the string theory?
I answered the wrong question, but for the question...
No, this is a...
Yeah, so the question that you asked, I was thinking you were in NC equals 3, but for K much less than NC, I believe that this is an effect where you have to really... you're looking at the effects of two string world sheets near each other, you have to look at the interactions. I don't think this... you have to do some sort of beta-saltpeter thing just as you would do for any bound state. I assume it's not a trivial problem to set up.
And one thing to say is that in many cases there is a dual picture of these strings in terms of D strings, and then you really see that if you have K strings together, you have a UK gauge theory, and then the dynamics of that gauge theory can easily lead to the sorts of things that you're mentioning. But it hasn't been shown yet.
It leads to the field theory. I wanted to see how it shows up on the string theory.
Well, if there's some S duality, which is what this is, then a fundamental string can become a D string, and then that's the type of situation that can happen.
He means a UK two-dimensional theory. It's a UK, not UN, UK theory on the string world sheet in the D string case. So it is a two-dimensional effect.
Okay, so that's an effect, David, and move on to our final presenter. So our final presenter will be Matt Strasser.
Okay, well, Okay, so
my intention is to look at some of the questions which I hope are very, you know, sort of raised by the conference and are very interesting to me and hopefully to many of you, that hopefully point some way towards the future. And they go in various different directions. I don't have any coherence to these, but I want them to, the intention is that they raise some issues for us to discuss for the rest of the hour. A first thing I want to bring up is that was, I guess, obvious to everyone, is that self-dual Yang-Mills is floating around in here. We haven't really isolated why. And this was actually, to my knowledge, first brought to my attention by Bill Bardeen in the context of MHV amplitudes. I believe he's the first one who pointed out that was what they were about. And we now know that they are not only interesting in themselves, but in some ways they're building blocks for other amplitudes, which is really very interesting. And we heard today they also arise in the branching of partons into jets, which is very interesting indeed. And we also heard that they play a special role, spin chains of chiral Fs, F mu nus, play a very special role in integrability. And so, you know, it's floating around here, but where precisely? What can we do? Can we sort of build Yang-Mills theory or N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory off of a self-dual version, as would be suggested by the version of this theory, version of N equals 4 suggested by Siegel. And we were reminded of that by Witten. Now, in the middle of all of this, of course, in the middle of all the interesting things that one can say about these stories, suddenly conformal supergravity appears, and in some relation to topological string theory. And analogy to Robbie's comment about the muon, I'd like to ask who clicked on that? It's what is that doing here? I don't think one should take the point of view that it's purely a pollution, as Svee Byrne did. It's presumably interesting in its own right, and I think these one-loop amplitudes ought to be computed. One should find out what happens. Why does it have to be there? What's it telling us about the N equals 4 theory? Another topic that was really quite amazing is this a possibility that Rick has really discovered a universal new liquid, which, for lack of a better name, I'll call Horizon. And, you know, is it universal? Are there atomic analogs that we can actually play with? And especially, what other black brain or stringy physics can we think of that it might be possible for Rick to go looking for? Obviously, a lot of thought needs to go into trying to get our way from the TUF coupling much smaller than 1 through that very interesting region where it's of order 1 out to where it's infinite and back again. We certainly have started to find, it would be great to find more examples of things that are lambda-independent universals, either independent or quasi-independent, things that are true both at strong and weak coupling, and therefore if you learn about them on one side, you're learning something deep about them on the other side as well. Now, of course, the infrared of QCD, if you're just worried about the infrared, the running coupling goes towards lambda equals 1. And there are some cases where lambda equals 1 may not be very different for particular processes from lambda equals infinity. But we need to understand under what circumstances does that happen and why. To do that, to some degree, perhaps we need some improvement in the 1 over square root of lambda expansion in our understanding of it to figure out why some properties are more robust than others. We certainly know some things that are very different at large lambda and small lambda, even things that are very different at large lambda and lambda of order 1. So it's not going to work for everything, but it may work for some things. It'd be nice to know which ones. And of course, we'd like to go from the other side and resum spin chains or whatever other methods we might have in lambda. And that certainly doesn't seem out of the question, especially in N equals 4, where integrability may help us out. Now, just for fun, let me throw out something which is probably completely crazy. But you know, there is this old puzzle of the NSVZ beta function. It's got a pole in it. And that pole sits at lambda equals 1. The beta function for lambda, not for g squared, has nothing in it except lambda. There's no n's. And so there's this funny pole, and it's there. You don't really know what to do with this gauge beta function beyond lambda equals 1. And that pole is there no matter how many flavors you've got. It's still floating around. You don't know what it really means. On the other hand, it's curious, probably unrelated, but nonetheless it's curious, that when you go to lambda much larger than 1, the supergravity A or C theorem tends to make the TUF coupling, forces the TUF coupling to shrink, generally. I don't know if this is really true everywhere, but it's certainly true in the warped form conifold. The beta function for lambda actually goes the other way, not because the dilaton is changing, but because the number of colors is decreasing. I don't know what to make of that, but maybe there's something interesting going on there. I would say my understanding, and perhaps our understanding, of high energy and small x physics is rather unsatisfactory. And this is definitely a place where string theory should have something to say. I mean, there's an obvious string theory physics with Reggie physics and the Pomeroy, saturation and unitarization and Froissart bound and black holes. These all came up. But then when you try to look at the Hera data and see what is actually going on, you look at Fermilab data and try to make sense of what people have done in the past, it just doesn't seem to all fit together in a clean way. So there are real questions there. I think the talk that we heard on Hera made it clear, as much as anything else, to the point that there wasn't a clear story, that, well, there isn't a clear story, and there's much more to do. Now, something I think is enormously important is the issue of jets. There's a lot that goes into a jet, into jet physics. There are parton amplitudes. We learned a lot about how to calculate those better. But then there's the branching. Each parton splits into many, many partons as it radiates out to longer distances. And then those partons turn into hadrons. And each one of those steps is interesting theoretically. It's difficult theoretically. There's lots of stuff to do. And it's absolutely crucial for LHC that we improve our ability to handle a lot of issues there. And, we can't treat this as an issue that's messy and so, well, somebody else will work on it. It's also mathematically really interesting. There are a lot of formal problems here that are not worked out. And I want to emphasize this is legitimate territory for string theorists. You should not view this as something which is outside your field. It's something which is inside your field and very important to the future of the field that you're working in. We've heard a lot of interesting things about dimension less than 4, Yang-Mills, matrix models, orbital field projections. There are so many wonderful, powerful tools here. We even heard a potential application to Yang-Mills, to at least one flavor QCD today, which I was quite impressed by. But it would be great if there were more. I mean, we know there are lots of things you can learn qualitatively. But can we get even more concrete applications? What can we get out of this, especially for non-supersymmetric theories where we don't have other techniques? And of course, not only D less than 4 is interesting, but N less than 4 is interesting. We really, in order to make the full use of what we've got, we need more powerful supergravity and string tools for building supergravity solutions and for calculating in supergravity solutions. Because we've really not had very many invented in the last couple of years. And even the ones we have, we can't calculate in for the most part. So we know there are good things being done in that, and I hope to see lots of more advances there. And on the other side, and I sort of feel like I put this in as an afterthought, but I didn't mean to. One of the things that was emphasized to us is that the lattice is a conceptual tool, not just a numerical tool. And we should really think of it that way and try to come up with more things that we can suggest to our lattice colleagues about what they could do to push our understanding of these various theories forward.
Okay. Questions?
Can you say more about what did you mean by when you say Hera and all the data do not fit together, or what
well,
is that?
Well, I guess if my understanding were complete, it would be easier for me to put my finger on that. But the problem is that the Hera data is sitting in a rather strange region where it's quite possible that there is no simple description of it. So when I talk to people from different parts of the community, I get different answers from every person I speak to. My conclusion, not being an expert, is that there's a lot of controversy. Now, by the older data, I'm specifically referring to various fits that show that various amplitudes grow like S to the 0.08. And this works great. Various cross-sections grow this way. This works for a whole bunch of different, something universal going on in there. On the other hand, at Hera, one sees this much more rapid growth. There's a Q-squared dependence that I personally don't completely understand. And it's certainly possible that there are, first of all, there's some BFKL physics in there, but there's also some saturation going on at the same time. And how those fit together, I don't know. But the experts really should answer that question more than me.
Well, but at least one thing is clear. It's Hera has two variables. Kinematics of Hera allows you to change mass, S, and Q squared.
Yep.
Therefore, it's natural that the Pomeroy slope, which is 0.08 in soft physics, can depend on Q squared. And this is what Hera has discovered. It's not controversy.
Okay, let me emphasize that there are certainly people, probably in this audience, who would disagree with that statement. Is this true? Okay, we got one. Okay, that's what I'm talking about.
It's me. I'm afraid there is some confusion in the following sense, that one of the reasons why sort of we meet to get here together, because you're trying to push Kosygin and Peterbotev regime. And what people who are working for Kosygin for many years were trying to do, they were trying to avoid this regime. The consequence of that, they were measuring those observables which are less sensitive than Peterbotev physics with respect to those which were not measured. So therefore, in this list, we're talking about hero physics. The basic idea of hero physics was starting Peterbotev regime and to see whether out of Peterbotev regime we get known something about Peterbotev Kosygin. And we learned a lot. And all these discrepancies you mentioned appeared after you start to push Kosygin in the limit when it was supposed to work.
Right.
And to my opinion, the problem is that if Kosygin works too well, if you look really for prediction that had been done on Kosygin's side, there is very few exceptions. Very small kinematical windows, we don't understand how Kosygin works.
Okay, well that may well be, but I have had multiple conversations with some very smart people, including people like Al Mueller, and I get different answers from everybody, and I look at the literature, it seems different. So I'm confused, and it would be great if you guys could tell us as a group what you really think.
Let me see whether Grisha agree. Now, perturbative studies in QCD went into two completely different roads. One is, say, jet type of physics, and the other is Regge type of physics, that means small x. So while in jet type of physics you can constrain your ignorance about a long distance, because you have a large scale, because power correction go down, hadronization correction go down like power. In rigid physics, you cannot avoid never a non-perturbative region. So far, and therefore, it is very difficult. And probably it's true that it's the first place where the strings has to act. The other reason which make difficult differently two fields of perturbative analysis of QCD is the fact that jet physics got a lot of advantage of having comparison with data. Data are not interesting, but they are challenging. They are interesting, but mostly they are challenging. You are trying to do something and you want to reach the accuracy in order to claim that you want to compare with the data. So data are important also as a way to push the study. In small x physics, you have the structure function, which is a function. You have the cross-section, which is a function of S. That's all. I mean, there's not much constraint from the data. Now there is this new feature which is very, very difficult, which is try to understand whether there is saturation, whether there is indication of a saturation regime. I don't think that they are foolproof indications. Probably at LHC there will be some sign, clear sign. That will be a very interesting piece of physics, which probably is not perturbative at all. It's a strong coupling regime which you can study by perturbative technique, but probably they are not adequate. So that is another field where I agree string theory should be very important, should be pushed in that direction.
Okay, so let's thank Matt and move on. So
I
now
think
we can.
We should all thank the organizers.
Well,
they did such a great job in such a bad environment.
So you're welcome, but we still want to continue the discussion. So maybe let me raise the first more general question for the discussion. So one interesting topic in which there has been some progress in the last few years, but it wasn't mentioned yet at this conference, is proving dualities between open and closed strings by world sheet methods. and we have some people who worked on that, like Hiroshi and Leonardo. So my question is, how many years will it take us to derive the ADS-CFT correspondence?
So I understand that it is, if indeed the world sheet theory is solvable in the case of ADS5 versus 5, as the recent paper seems to suggest, then we'll have a better handle on how the world sheet would behave in the limit which correspond to the small to hoofed coupling. And in the simpler case in which I worked on and Leonardo worked on, other cases we have very good control of the world sheet physics in the regime when two-foot coupling constant is small. And we start seeing how sort of world sheet start creating holes which are to become boundaries and then identified with the gauge theory degrees of freedom. So I think that developing techniques to control the world sheet dynamics in the regime for small to fluid coupling, if that comes with this integrability project, would be a very promising lead toward deriving ADS-CFT correspondence from a microscopic point of view.
Okay. More questions, comments? Questions to any of our speakers?
No, I just want to point out that even if we succeed in doing that, then of course that would only have proven it at n equals infinity. I mean, free strings and planar n equals 4. Then, so in its stronger form, you have to then look at string interaction and so on and so forth. So then we're still not going to be done, even if we prove that.
Well, I want to stress that at least to all order in string perturbation theory, the open closed string duality is a world sheet statement. So if you have a way to understand microscopically on a given world sheet how the boundaries start appearing, how the world sheet start developing holes, then that is a proof of open closed string duality to all order in perturbation theory. This is a local statement on the world sheet, I would like to stress. I mean, at least the way that I would expect to see the proof is going to be developed, I think that would be a sufficient understanding. At least two, and then if you want to go beyond that, of course, there has to be some definition of non-perturbative definition of string theory, which is independent of the gauge theory. So you can see that does not exist so far. So I it would be a total order to ask for it.
Just to ask a question. So we are all looking for a string theory description of QCD. Is there at least a demonstration of principle that such a theory exists? Well, in the form of string theory in some very curved space in horrible background, etc. Is there at least a demonstration of principle that there is a deformation of n equal 4 super Young Mills that in the weak coupling limit that in the infrared behaves like pure Young Mills at large n.
Okay. Since you analyzed it.
Well, I mean, I mean, for n equals one supersymmetry, we have certain statements we can make. But your question was somewhat.
You can make the same statement.
Yeah. So your question was sort of multi-part, and the issue is how do you, the issue in part is how do you get to the non-supersymmetric theory, because the of course you can, you know, take one of these theories that's supersymmetric and break the supersymmetry a little bit, and then try to take the limit that you would have to take to get to a theory which is supersymmetric well above the confinement scale, and there are no analytic tools for that from the supergravity point of view. Now, from the point of view of string theory, I'm out of my league here. I mean, this is really, I'm not an expert enough string theorist to say what's been known. But I believe that one is more likely to do better first in lower dimensions. And I would be curious if any of the other speakers who worked on that would have anything to say about trying to go to non-supersymmetric contexts there, and about those that are already known.
Well, if you ask for proof in principle, how about just considering string theory in Schwarzschild solution? If you consider a string theory in ADS and just raise the temperature, and then one should reproduce a non-supersymmetric theory one dimension lower, and that is expected to flow to pure glue, I thought.
One should worry about in these non-supersymmetric cases is that we might have phase transitions. So we know how to define the non-supersymmetric angles as a limit of some string theories, but you might worry that there would be some phase boundary in the middle that you would have some problem crossing. But at least as a limiting procedure, there is certainly no problem in defining non-supersymmetric angles as a limit of string theories that we know and understand. So hopefully there's no problem with that.
I guess I was taking it to the next step and asking, you know, to what extent do we actually have evidence of non-supersymmetric theories where such a phase transition does not take place? Or can we get one?
I just wanted to point out somehow that we have qualitative change in amplitude. In QCD, like in jet physics, for example, we always thought that there is perturbative QCD with some cascading of partons. And only when it becomes non-perturbative, it is somehow related with confinement, that there are strings breaks, things like this. The whole lesson of Rieck shows that this is not the case, that when you create this liquid, there's no confinement, we are in the confined phase. We just went from weak coupling phase to strong coupling phase, and it qualitatively changed regime, yes, but it has nothing to do with confinement, yes. There is no obvious connection to that. It just
I think I should mention that we learned this from ADS CFT before we learned it from Rick, but that's just a historical comment.
So ADS CFT, which has kind of continuous motion from weak coupling to strong coupling. The other question I had actually to all specialists: why do you believe there is no phase transition in lambda? Is it true that we know that?
You mean in N equals 4 supersymmetric Higgs mills, or?
I'd like to comment about the first part of
calculation, because people did perturbative cascades, very elaborate, etc. They're qualitatively wrong. Yes, they just don't describe collectivity.
Yeah, but for large field,
People wrote large field and solved classical fields that also absolutely did not correspond. Absolutely not. The strong Young-Mills field very quickly become gluons, and the gluons don't speak to each other and become perturbative cascade again. That is not it.
Okay, let me answer the second question first. So the answer to the second question is that in supersymmetric theories, one can actually prove almost rigorously that there are no phase transitions when you change the coupling. So at least in the supersymmetric case, we know that there is no phase transition between small and large lambda. In QCD itself, in N equals 4 in particular, and also in some cases with N equals 2 supersymmetry, but obviously in QCD itself, it's a big problem.
Well, there are two aspects in the small x physics. One is the large field, which is, say, non-perturbative type of physics. And the other is the fact that you cannot avoid excitation momenta which are in the long distance region. You always run into the large distance region, and you cannot avoid them when you go to small x. and they give contributions which are order one, not suppressed.
I want to make just a very small comment that, in fact, it's not that it just happened now after RIG, because people used to ask questions about QCD which go beyond confinement long ago. For instance, if you change the number of muscle flavors beyond certain limit, you are in the conformal window. And if you are just in the conformal window, it's still a strong coupling constant. All anomalous dimensions are large. So even the question at what number of flavors the conformal window begins, even this question is not decided. We definitely know that if an F is equal to 15 or 16 in SU3, we are in the conformal regime. But this is a weakly coupled conformal regime, which is not very interesting. Now we descend down to an F 11, 10, 7, I don't know. At a certain point, conformal regime becomes strongly coupled, but it's still a conformal regime.
I think one of the real puzzles, if you like, to the extent that the RIC data really does reflect an extreme low viscosity liquid, is that, you know, again, the calculation that Sohn and Policastro and Starnetz did is done at lambda very large. And we never had any reason to think that QCD would ever get there, and if we thought, you know, lambda go to one or something, or less, it'll get stopped if it's at finite temperature density. It won't even quite get to one. So to find something that's qualitatively similar to lambda equals infinity is a surprise, and I think that's one which really requires some thought.
Comment on that. If I take the formula that Alex Buchel and Andre and Jim Liu obtained and put in just very naively g square equal 1, then I get a correction which is 10-20%.
This is the fact that the correction is lambda to 1 is 1 over lambda to 3 halves, correct? Which? Wait for the mic.
Yeah, actually, I was trying to say is that result is very specific to n equal 4, and it depends on the structure of alpha prime corrections. In particular, one of the conditions is that in supergravity, the only correction, the alpha prime corrections enter as r to the fourth terms. When you start breaking supersymmetry, there will be r squared corrections, and that would lead to a different, not minus 3/2, but minus 1/2. So that correction will be stronger than what you would get if you just simply use our formula.
Okay, so let's thank all the speakers and presenters in this conference, which made it so interesting. Conference is officially over.